Reading with your kids.
Hola, ni hao, konnichiwa, assalamu alaikum, shalom, mahaba, ciao, bonjour, namaste, jumbo. Bienvenidos. Hey, my name is Jet Li. You are listening to Reading with Your Kids. We are broadcasting with love out to the world from the beautiful neighborhood of Reedville, the loveliest corner of Boston, Massachusetts. We are so very delighted and absolutely honored that you join us in our mission to help all families grow closer through reading. We do that by sharing fun, thoughtful, and thought-provoking conversations with fascinating people who just happen to be writing books for kids of all ages. You can join us in our mission by telling all of your family and friends about the show and letting them know that they can hear us on the WREB AM-FM 24/7 Radio Network. And they can find us on the iHeartRadio app, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, Podcast Addict, Amazon Music, CastBox, Player FM, Audible, YouTube. Wherever you find your favorite shows, you can find Reading with Your Kids. Really wonderful show lined up for you today. First up, Jenny Holm is coming back to Reading with Your Kids to celebrate her new middle grade novel. It's called Outside. Later in the show, Deborah Olivia Farmer will be here to celebrate My Journey to Joshua, From Fear to Families. And joining us to celebrate his new book, The Roast Beef Chief, The Broccoli Redemption, Jacob Teat. Right now, here's Jenny Holm. Ah, my friends, I'm so excited. I'm excited to welcome back to the show our guest today. We're celebrating her new middle grade novel. It's called Outside. Please welcome to the show three-time Newbery Honor winner, best New York Times bestselling author, and an all-around great person, Jennifer Holm. Hey, Jennifer, how are you?
I'm so good. Thank you for having me back on. This is such a treat.
Delighted to have you on. I think, Jen, you were the first New York Times bestselling author that popped on the show. We were struggling. We had lots of indie and self-published authors, you know, when we started out back in 2017. I don't remember the year that you came on, but I do remember being very excited. And then once you're on the show, I'm like, man, that lived up to all its expectations.
Aw. No, I mean, we all started somewhere, right? Everybody.
This is true.
We've all had a few rejected books, or more than a few, so.
Absolutely. Tell us about Outside. Before we hit record, you were telling me that this is kind of a departure for you.
Yeah, so I've been in the middle grade space for my career doing novels, but I've traditionally done historical fiction, and I've done some contemporary. I did do one sci-fi book called The Line of Mars, but that was really grounded in hard science. So I feel like, in a way, it was kind of futuristic historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Outside is really different than anything I've written. It's a post-apocalyptic dystopian story about a group of kids who are growing up in an abandoned millionaire's compound after there's been a world war and most of humanity's been wiped out. Just a happy little...
Just a happy romp in the park.
Yeah. It's funny when you try to tell your own books, you're like, wait, that sounds really dark, actually.
So what was it like visiting that dark place in your mind?
You know, it was very interesting. So the kernel for the idea actually came from my childhood. And this is the story. So I'm one of five kids and I'm the middle girl and I have all brothers. And my oldest brother is 12 years older than me. So that was a pretty big age gap. So when I was just in kindergarten or first grade, he graduated high school and he joined the Navy. And, you know, so my big brother was there one day and the next he was gone. And I was completely befuddled. Like, what happened to Keith? Where did he go? And why wasn't he coming home for dinner? And why wasn't he playing with me? And my parents kept saying, well, Jenny, he joined the Navy, which is very funny because I'm a Navy brat, but you don't really understand things when you're a little kid. And I guess I was just so worried and I nagged my parents. I drove my dad a little nuts, I think, because one day we're driving in this, this business park, and he points to this big building and he says, Jenny, that's the Navy. That's where Keith is. he's fine. You don't have to worry about him any longer. And I was like comforted. And, you know, it come to realize a couple of years later, that's just the IBM building in town. So, you know, my parents told me this white lie. And for years, it was a family joke. Like, we'd drive by it, and my dad would say, everybody wave to the Navy, wave to Keith. Meanwhile, he was, like, in Alaska or something. But years later, I thought, you know, wouldn't it be funny? Like, what if there were, like, a bunch of kids living in that building and nobody knew what was going on?
Mm.
What would the reality be?
Yeah, yeah. It's wild. It's so funny. Your dad sounds like a pretty fun guy.
He was the king of pulling a long-running practical joke. That was the one joke. The second most famous one was he drove a red Volkswagen Beetle. And, you know, this is the 70s when we all sat in the front seat. And so we would fight to sit in the front seat to be able to push the horn. There was a little bee on the dash. And when you push the bee, the horn would honk. And we love that. And it wasn't until I was 15 and I was getting my driver's permit and then I'm in control, I'm in the car, my dad's teaching me how to drive, and I push the B button and nothing happens. Because the B on the Volkswagen, it was for battery, like low battery. But he kept that going for 15 years with me. I thought every time I would touch it, he would honk the horn. So, yeah, I mean, adults are capable of, like, keeping a joke for a long time.
Well, I can relate to that. There is a statue in front of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts of an Indian chief. And it's a beautiful statue. And he has this long headdress on. And he's like this to the sun with his arms outstretched. And my dad, we had always heard that my great-great-grandmother was a Native American and a princess, in fact. And so my dad would say, well, that's your grandfather. That's who your grandmother was married to. And he was so strict. All my cousins, we all bought it. Mm-hmm. And about 5 years ago, one of my cousins took one of those DNA heritage tests, and it came back white, whiter, whitest. It's nowhere off the British Isles, where there's no DNA from anywhere except the British Isles.
So funny.
Yes. But he had the tribe down and everything. It was just classic.
Very elaborate.
Yes. So you in your book, Razzie is a kid growing up in this compound, and Razzie hears that there's danger outside of the compound.
Yeah. So basically what happened, the setup for the book is 12 years earlier, there was a massive world war that became known as the Great Poisoning. So in this war, instead of like nuclear weapons, countries attacked each other with poison, and they ended up, it became like mutually assured destruction. They totaled the earth, killed most of the humans. And if you were an unlucky human who had been hit with the poison and you survived, you became like a zombie-like creature. So those zombie-like creatures that they call them the poisoned are free roaming the countryside and attack. So Razzie and the other children, there's seven children. Basically what happened was a couple of families with young children banded together right when the war started, and they took over this abandoned compound because it had high walls. It seemed really safe and defensible. And so these kids have grown up here. They've never known anything else. And they're having an okay childhood, actually, but they can't go outside because of the poison roaming the countryside. And so the adults have literally boarded up all of the windows. And so they're only allowed to, like, go into the courtyard of this compound maybe once a year for what the grown-ups call a little peek, to just be outside in the fresh air, because they're so worried about these zombie-like creatures, like, throwing themselves over the walls.
Mm.
So, yeah, so outside is a very dangerous world for the children.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did this book begin coming together during the pandemic when we're all afraid that we were going to turn into zombies?
I know. It actually didn't. I wrote it after the pandemic, and it was strangely usually I take, you know, a year to knock out a first draft. This was the fastest first draft I've ever written. I sat down and wrote it in like 3 months. But then, of course, revised it many, many times after that over the years.
Yeah. So how did you like writing in this space?
You know what? It was fun. I still had to do some research, like, to imagine what a dystopian future would be like. It was a little depressing also. So the other thread in the book is that, so Razia is growing up in this compound, and early in the first chapter, we find out that her heart, they discovered that her heart is failing, and this is the future, and they've perfected organ transplants. So right now, like, what's hard about getting an organ transplant isn't necessarily getting the organ, although that's hard, but it's really, you have to take a lot of medication so your body doesn't reject the organ. So if you get a new heart, in this future world, they've perfected that. And so they don't actually even need to use human organs anymore. They can use animal organs. So the humans capture a greyhound named Wind, and greyhounds have big hearts, literally almost as big as a child's heart. And they put the heart, Wind's heart, into her chest. And so the dog dies, very sad and bittersweet, but she lives. And so I was trying to imagine, you know, what are the ethics of taking the heart of an animal or a body part and putting it in a human body? Would something happen, like, with your soul or your senses? Like, what would that be like?
Wow. There's a lot to contemplate there. What did you come up with, any conclusions?
I mean, in the book, what starts to happen is she starts to almost feel a little bit of Wind, like a little bit of his soul is seeping into her. And I think I fixated on the heart because of something that did happen during COVID. One of my best friends, like, insanely healthy young woman, just went to the doctor, just went to her GP for like a checkup. Like, she got on insurance. She hadn't been on it for a couple of years, and went in, and her heart was failing. And she had to have this insane experimental heart surgery that only like one surgeon in the US has ever done. So it was crazy seeing somebody who's perfectly healthy being told that you're going to die in a month if you don't get the surgery. So,
Wow. Yeah,
you kind of realize like how fragile life is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And life can change in a moment.
So fast. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've shared here on the podcast, I was going to the gym every day for years and years and doing my educational magic shows and falling off stages and out of chairs never got hurt. And then I was taking my dogs out and missed step and ended up in a wheelchair for 3 months.
Oh, the worst.
And yes, so it's like, Yeah. This sounds like, Outside sounds like a book that would be a lot of fun to co-read with your kids and come together and talk about during dinner, because there's so many of those questions that I think arise. What are the kind of questions you think families can talk about as they're co-reading Outside?
Yeah, so I think also part of this book actually is sort of a meditation between my daughter and I about the differences, how we were different children. So I was a very obedient, well-behaved, never questioned adults kid. It was just, that was my DNA. It might have been the DNA of the 1970s a little bit too, but that was definitely how I was. And my daughter has never met an adult she wouldn't question. She questions everything. She's very opinionated. But also what's really interesting about her is, and I carry this into the book, so that in the book, Razia is this very responsible child. She's the oldest of the children, kind of parentified in a way, you know, how like older kids become the babysitter. So she's very rule following. There's a younger child named Ollie who questions everything, but he's also an artist and he wants to be able to draw what he can see. He wants to go outside and draw. And I really fixated on that in the book is because my daughter, Millie, she's in college now, but she is an artist, and her favorite thing for her and her friends to do, they like to go plain air painting, where, you know, you go set your easel up on the beach with your canvas and you paint what you see. It's like this very classic tradition from the 1800s in France. And it's really where the idea that the artist has to be able to see what they want to paint. So if you're an artist or, you know, a budding artist living in this compound and you want to paint, but you can't see anything, that's just a huge conflict, right, in your life.
Yeah. Wow. What's your daughter's reaction to the book?
Oh, my kids don't care anymore. I know. You know what? When they were little, they were really into my books. But now my daughter is reading really old sci-fi from like the 30s. So
you weren't
not
hoping
impressed
that,
at all.
You weren't hoping that she'd be impressed with Outside? Like, look, I did something different.
I was hoping she would read it, but neither of my kids are interested in reading my book. Maybe when they get older, they'll, you know, yeah. So maybe when they have kids of their own, they'll be forced to read grandma's books or something.
Tommy, is there a sequel to Outside coming?
There is not, but Matt, so I do the Baby Mouse books and the Sunny series and all the graphic novels with my brother Matt, and we've done like 45 graphic novels over the years, and so we are actually embarking on something new. We're writing a middle grade book together, and it's from the point of view of a dog, and that's because when I was writing this book, there is one chapter that I tell the story from the point of view of Wind, the greyhound, and it was mm-hmm. really fun writing from the point of view of an animal. So we decided to run with that. So that's what we're working on right now.
Awesome. And is that going to be a middle grade novel?
Yes. Yes.
Exciting. Exciting. Yeah. How is that the collaboration process? I've always been a great team player, whether it's on a sports team or in a work environment. I'm not able to create collaboratively all that well. I kind of give, you know, I come up with this great idea and then everybody kind of goes, oh, you should do this and this and this. And then when it finishes, I go, this ain't mine.
I mean, it's, everybody's really interested. So first of all, he's 6 years younger than me. So we weren't in the house at the same time. So we didn't have those traditional sibling clashes. We actually mm-hmm. clashed with the sibling between us because he was closer in age. So like we never rode the school bus together or even in the same schools. And it actually, we don't live near each other. So he actually is living in Italy at the moment. I live in California, and throughout our whole collaboration, we've never lived in the same city again. So it's always been virtual. And I think when you are, collaborating virtually, things are usually a lot easier, uh-huh. but honestly, it's always been an easy collaboration because we can use shorthand to communicate. Like, We grew up in the same house. So if we're trying to describe something, we can use those words. But also, we both came from industry. So before I was a children's author, I was a film producer. I produced television commercials at a big ad agency in New York City. And Matt was and that was for like 10 years. And Matt was an editor for a decade at Hearst Magazines.
Uh-huh.
So we were both used to being critiqued, you know, on a daily, hourly, minute basis, you know, and having our ideas come back covered with red lines.
Uh-huh.
So we know how to take criticism. So the way it generally works is if one of us feels strongly about something, they usually get their way because we realize the person is commenting not from an unkind, but they can see something that the person who wrote it can't mm-hmm. see.
Yeah.
Which I think is the biggest issue with me as a writer and most writers is that so much of the story is in our head. We assume that we put it on the paper, but oftentimes it's still in our head and we uh-huh. haven't put it on the paper, and somebody will read it and say, I don't understand why is this character doing this? And you have this elaborate backstory in your head that you haven't communicated effectively. So mm-hmm. editors uh-huh. are like the most important people in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that, you know, like, what do you mean? What do you mean you don't understand that? It's right there. But meanwhile, you haven't informed and educated the person about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's even easier. I mean, I really lucked out because he was a working editor. So he was used to editing other authors. So, like, I have an in-house editor, which is amazing.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Now, was he in on the Navy ruse?
Yes, he didn't he didn't understand for years what that was about. And he thinks it's so funny, yeah. It's just one of those family legends, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. Was it difficult for you to go back and write Outside by yourself after collaborating with Matt for so long?
It really was. You know, I started off as a solo author and then started working with Matt. And we've been working together for 20 years now because Baby Mouse just had its 20th anniversary this month in December, actually. And what's really nice about collaborating is when you get writer's block, you have somebody to help break that block. They can, mm-hmm. if I'm stuck, I can just send him the manuscript and I literally will, you know, will put star, 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 which just means I don't know what to do here. Something help me out. But with Outside, yeah, it's definitely not as fun. And, but I did it. Uh-huh. But I think what we are enjoying with this dog book I mentioned is it's so much easier when I'm stuck now I can send him and say, can you write this chapter? I'll write this chapter. Or can you give like a harsh critique of this chapter? So it's just easier.
Yeah. You mentioned the mats in Italy. I'm curious, have you ever had a chance to go to the, and this is probably a silly question, but the International Children's Book Festival in Bologna?
I haven't. I have been to Bologna many times. In fact, I was just in Italy visiting Matt, and we were supposed to go to Bologna. We booked it, and then me and his wife, we both got sick, so we had to cancel. But I love Bologna. I've never actually gone. Maybe I don't have a book coming out, like a big book coming out this year. Maybe when this dog book comes out, I can go, because I just love that town.
Isn't it beautiful?
It's so gorgeous. Yeah, I mean, I became acquainted with it not because of children's publishing. I went to a little college and then did a junior year abroad, and I went to London. Uh-huh. And all of my friends went abroad, and they either went to Toulouse, Malaga, or Bologna, where they had study abroad. So I was going down to Bologna all the time when I was in college. So that's when I first got to know it.
My beautiful wife and I went over for the Children's Book Festival. And first off, the size of the children's book industry, I had no idea how big it was until we were there, and it just blew us away. But the other thing that blew us away, you know, here in Boston, there's a Dunkin' Donuts on every corner. In Bologna, there's a cathedral, a beautiful cathedral on every corner.
And honestly, the food in that town is my favorite in all of Italy.
Yes.
My favorite food.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we should tell everybody where they can go. Well, they can go to Bologna if they want some bolognese or lasagna. But where can people go to find out more about outside and find out more about
you? Can go to my website, www.jenniferholm.com. You can get outside at your local bookstore, at your library, maybe in your classroom library. It's out there in the world.
We've had a great time speaking to the author of Outside, this great new middle grade novel from our guest, Jennifer Holm. Hey, Jenny, thanks so much for being back on Reading With Your Kids.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a great new year.
Before we invite our guest into the studio, I would love to invite you to visit a very special website. It's clownswithoutborders.org. clownswithoutborders.org. This is a group that I absolutely adore. I am part of Clowns Without Borders, and I had the honor of being part of the 2023 tour of El Salvador. I had so much fun joining with artists from all over the world to bring a smile to people who really needed it and really appreciated it too. And we would love for you to join us as a monthly joy maker. The joy makers, they're a family of people just like you who love to laugh and make other people feel good. So please take a moment and visit clownswithoutborders.org and consider joining me as a joy maker. This is going to be a very important and very powerful episode of Reading With Your Kids. Our guest is coming to us from Georgia, celebrating her memoir. It's called My Journey to Joshua. Please welcome to the show, Deborah Olivia Farmer. Deborah, how are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. How are you?
I am wonderful. I'm really looking forward to this. Joshua is your son.
Joshua is my 10-year-old double digits son. Yes.
That's wonderful. Tell me, and Joshua, in the notes that you sent me, you talked about non-traditional paths to family.
Yes.
Am I quoting you right?
You are absolutely quoting me right. And so my story to my journey to Joshua, I am a foster care and adoption advocate. I was introduced to the foster care system while working in local television in Chicago. And so while working in local television, I'm a very, you know, community-minded individual. I'm a member of a lot of organizations that service the community. And so I wanted to go a little bit further, and I reached out to a friend of mine that worked for a social service agency. And I, you know, hey, I want to mentor a young lady. And so he connected me with a young lady who happened to be in foster care. And so that was how I was introduced to foster care. And this was in the late 90s. And so it was something always on my heart, something I knew that I wanted to do. It was to, in some way, you know, be a foster parent. And so many years later, that's how I met my son. I actually went through the foster care process, got my license, and I adopted my son through foster care.
Well, people have heard me say this before. I think that you and other adopted parents and foster parents are heroes.
Thank you.
You chose to give a child a forever home.
Yes.
And right now there are about 400,000 kids in foster care waiting for a forever home. And it's a beautiful thing. It's not an easy thing. It's challenging and hard work, but I think it's worth it. And it is certainly, you're saving lives. And so I know the first thing you're going to say is, no, Joshua saved my life. And I've gotten so much from it. And that's what I hear from every foster parent.
Yes.
An adopted parent. But it took the courage for you to say, I'm going to do this. That made it happen.
Yeah, you know, and there's a saying that, you know, we're not here to change the world, but we do have capacity to change the world of a child. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you know, you get the same stories. Oh, no, they changed, you know, my life, which he has. Mm-hmm. But we are, you know, in a position where we can provide a loving home to a child in need. And that's what we chose to do.
That's beautiful. So tell me, how has your life changed since you made that decision?
Yeah. And so, you know, just backstory, I worked in television right out of college. And so the years of working in TV, the hours were very odd. You know, I worked very early hours, sometimes really late hours. And so, of course, when you are a parent, you have to find a way to balance that out. And so it's really provided me an opportunity to have some balance in my life when my son became my child and, you know, came into my home. And so it's changed in ways of understanding the work-life balance, right? Mm-hmm. Understanding that you can be committed to your career, but you also have to have commitment to family. And so that was one of the ways that, you know, me being a parent through foster care has changed my life.
You know, as you said, I've never thought about this, but I had a flashback to the time before I met my beautiful wife, and working in human services at that time, and just being full bore with the career and everything, and it just consumed my life. It's, you go in there, and then afterwards you go out and have dinner with the people that you're working with, and then you socialize, and it was. I didn't understand when my married coworkers would say, "Up, time for me to go home." What do you mean? We got to go out and we got to do this and we got to do that. And I am so happy. I am as far away from that as I can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because family is so much more rewarding.
It really is, you know, and again, having the interesting career path that I chose, again, going into television, you meet a lot of cool people. But when you have conversations with those cool people, many of them talk about their families, right? Mm-hmm. And so in as much as you think you're saving the world, whatever it is not as important as your family. And so I'm grateful that I had the opportunity again to parent through foster care and adopt my child and understand that there is a thing called work-life balance. And I'm glad that I achieved that.
Yeah. I know that there are going to be people out there who are listening saying, yeah, but it's not for me. It's really hard. What are some of the challenges that you experience?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge that most people have, which is my second book, actually, that I wrote after my journey to Joshua, which is Fears to Families, is that they don't have the information. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges is because people make up, you know, what they assume, right? So that's false evidence appearing real. That's all fear is, right? And so when you don't have information, you're not able to make an informed decision. And so for me, I think that's one of the challenges is people just don't have the proper information. I think that if they educate themselves on this process, if they, you know, talk to others that are in community that have gone through this experience, you know, have lived experience, that's a way to get beyond the challenge that's in place. We do understand and we know through foster care that, you know, there's going to be some trauma there. You're breaking. There's some brokenness there, whether the child was deliberately put into foster care or whatever the case might be. Mm-hmm. So there is some trauma there, but there are support groups in place to help you get through those challenges, right? And so I'm just here to provide solutions. You know, again, I'm about solving problems. And so if you find yourself, you know, I'm not sure that this is what I want to do, I just say, you know, at least do some research on an organization, right, that you might want to foster a child through and go to a class. Mm-hmm. That's just the first thing that you can do for yourself is just to take a step, move forward.
You know, I was telling Deborah before we started recording about Dr. John DeGarmo, who has been on the show, and he was a person who educated me to the numbers. And, you know, that here in the States, it's an average of 360 to 400,000 kids every day in foster care. Do you know, is that percentage of kids, is that found around the world of kids that are in foster care, not living in a family, or is that happening here in the States that is causing that?
Yeah, you know, that's a very good question. My folks are from Barbados, and my dad and his brother. And so I was talking to one of my cousins who happened to be traveling through on business, and he was talking about my uncle who actually fostered children in Barbados. And so I don't think that this is an issue just in our country. I think this is a worldwide, wide issue. Mm-hmm. Where unfortunately some families just might not have the proper structure to support a family, right? And so you find yourself, whether through, whatever the situation might be, that provides you, unfortunately, this situation where you have to have someone else assist you with your children. And that's what foster care is. I think the other layer to this too is just understanding what the difference is between foster care and adoption. Foster care is really, the objective is to reunite the children with their biological families. And you are at least allowing the family the opportunity to get their stuff together, whatever that might be. And you're just literally, you know, a safety net. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think if people take that approach, even I think what I've heard a lot is that people get fearful that they're going to get attached to the child and then they don't want to. But then what's your why? Do you want to be a foster parent or do you want to be an adoptive parent? Right. And so having that understanding will give you some context on which way to go at this. But to your point and to your question, I think this is a worldwide issue. This is not an issue just here in the United States.
Yeah. I've heard people say, I'd love to help, but boy, I don't want to get attached to the kid. And then the kid leaves and my heart is broken. I intellectually understand that, but man, when you open yourself up to love, what a gift that is.
Absolutely. I think that's the one piece that I, again, push strongly in from fears to families is that fear and love cannot reside in the same space. Mm-hmm. And so if you have that level of fear in place, then you're preventing yourself from opening up to love. Mm-hmm. And love is the greatest gift of all, right? And so why not? I think we just, again, tend to lean into, I think, the fear element for not having the information. And you're, again, false evidence of things appearing real, right? That's really all fear is. And so you've assumed that you're going to get attached to the child. Possibly. Again, when I think about how I was introduced to foster care, I was mentoring a young lady that was to be a one-year relationship. Mm-hmm. I was just supposed to help her with her homework for 1 year. And here it is. She was 8 years old at the time. She's 34 years old and she's still in my life. So it's the choice that you make. I never fostered her. I just was her big sister. I am still her big sister. And so how do you approach it? How do you decide to pull some positive from this and not lead with the excuses of, oh my goodness, I'm going to get attached and my heart will be broken? Possibly, but possibly not. And so thankfully, for me, you know, this young lady is still in my life all these years later.
Yeah. We've hosted international kids in our home and every one of them are still part of our family, even though they're in China or Italy or the Netherlands. They're still, and thankfully through the magic of technology, I'm in touch with them on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's the choice that you make. I think oftentimes we are in our own way. And so for those that have the excuse that they're going to have whatever negative, that is pretty much on them. I'm not dismissing their feelings at in any way. But to your point, you know, when you think about it, who wouldn't want to at least risk love? It's like having your heart broken in a relationship for the mm-hmm. first time. Do you not go back and get into another relationship?
Right.
No.
Right. Yeah. Now, you fostered Joshua, you became adopted parents, but
yeah.
It's much more right now. You've become a very strong and vocal advocate.
Yes.
What pushed you to, you know, kind of get out there and pick up this flag and carry it?
Yeah, that's a very dynamic question. And so for me, my temperament and my spirit has always been that of service. How can I help other people, right? And so when I went through the process, there were so many people that were so excited for me, and they oftentimes shared that this is something that they wanted to do, and they never did it. And so I was like, there's got to be a reason why they are not doing this thing. They see the joy that I have. They see the love that I have. Why wouldn't they want that for themselves? And oftentimes, they were just afraid. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I put on this hat of advocacy, because I wanted to be able to encourage, to inspire. And then I think not only am I relatable, it's an authentic story, right? It's not some, you know, manufactured story because of social media now, and I want to be, you know, mm-hmm. the next influencer. But yeah, I do want to influence people in this space to move from fear to love. And so that's why I've picked up this, you know, mantle, if you will, to continue advocating. And I'm strongly advocating for those that want to parent, that want to nurture and to look at things differently. You know, you may have had your heart set out to be, you know, maybe carry a child, but unfortunately life happened. And so now you're going to just put that desire to the side. You want to be a parent. And so I just really want people to think about it differently. And then the other part too, this is not charity work. This is community building, right? And so as a community-minded person, when you look at the stats, 400,000 children are in foster care, and you can do something about that. This is a community issue. I think mm-hmm. we should all take a strong look at that and find ways that we can, you know, right the wrong here.
Yeah. I know it's different in every state, but can you talk a little bit about the process if somebody's listening to this and thinking, yeah maybe I want to give this a shot? What's the first thing they should do?
I think the first thing they should do is to know their why. And I lead with that in everything, because you can't look at this like you're going to be some savior, like you're not doing this to go and save a child, right? This is, you have to understand what is your objective and your agenda here, right? What's in it? You know, why are you doing this? And so once you have that understanding, that's the first step. And then the second one would be to do some research on social service agencies. There are tons of agencies out here, and it's no different than you. If you decide you want to apply for a job, do you not do research on the organization that you want to work for? And so in this case, I definitely and strongly recommend that people do research on these agencies, because every agency is different. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another level of advocacy too, is many of these agencies, they're tapped out, mm-hmm. you know, so they're over max with their caseload of children that they're trying to service. And then they're trying to service, you know, incoming foster parents. So I think, again, it's a little bit stretched in that regard. And so doing the research will get you the best results. And so that's my second recommendation. And then once you've done that, I recommend that you go to an orientation, mm-hmm. find out more about it, you know, talk to folks like myself and others that have lived experience so that they can help you through this process so that you can make an informed decision.
Yeah. Boy, you know, I worked in human services. I was working in the juvenile justice system for a small nonprofit organization. But they also had in the other half of the office, there was a foster care. And, mm-hmm. and boy, those caseworkers had an incredible amount of kids that they were trying to service and help. Whereas I was dealing with 4 or 5 kids in my caseload, they had at least 30, 60 kids that
Absolutely.
They were trying to place. And what a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you imagine that just across the world, right? Can you just imagine how max they are even today? And so when you think about that, are these children being properly serviced, even with the support that they think that they should have, which is their caseworker, right? And so, again, that's the due diligence that the potential foster parent should do, is to make certain that the organization has capacity to support your needs, so that you, because this is a lot. Once you've gone through this process, you're not done after you've signed the adoption papers or the foster care license. This is year-round work. This is a lifetime commitment. And so you want to make certain that you safeguard yourself from any, you know, hiccups along the way, right? And so, like in my instance, again, I formed a relationship with the agency, the caseworker. I go to orientation sometimes, and I speak to potential foster parents through this organization, but that's because I still have a relationship with the case manager at the time. And that was over 10 years ago.
Yeah. So important. What would you say to the parent? I've actually heard this in my own life. Boy, we want to be parents. We can't do it because of a medical issue, but I can't raise somebody that's not from me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's ego-based. And so not to, again, be dismissive, because that's a real feeling, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you a funny story. So I wanted a girl. So when I was going through this process, you know, they ask you, it's almost like you can, you know, unfortunately create your scenario, right? And so you can create what you want. And I wanted a girl, and they kept calling me with boys. So I had to move out of my own way and say, I want to be a parent. It doesn't matter if it's a girl or a boy, right? And so for the person that's on the fence and they're like, oh, no, I don't know if I can raise someone else's child, or because I didn't biologically, you know, have this child, then I don't want to be involved. I think that's ego-based, because there's the assumption that you're going to get a troubled child, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's not fair, because you could possibly birth a child that has, you know, issues yourself. And so that's, I think a lot of that is ego-based. And again, that's fear-based. There are only two emotions, fear and love. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's it.
I know that not everybody is in the position to be a foster parent or be an adoptive parent, but I think everybody is in the position to support families that have chosen to be foster families. I've mentioned many times on the show, I have somebody in my life that I am incredibly close to that came into our family through the foster system, and I can't imagine life without her.
Yeah.
What are some of the ways that we can support foster families in our neighborhood or in the community at large?
Yeah, that's a very great question. I think, you know, depending upon your, you know, affiliation of, you know, whether it be a faith-based organization, a community service organization, a school, you know, again, you're talking about 400,000 children. So clearly they are in one of these capacities, whether it be church, Boys and Girls Club, or your local block club. You can get involved in that way. You know, the holidays is the best time to get involved, because there are ways where you can join with, whether it be Salvation Army. You know, I can start rattling off all types of organizations where you can go and be of service. And you will be hard-pressed to not think that there will be one child amongst all those children that might possibly be in foster care, right? Mm-hmm. And so in that, there are tons of ways that you can be of service, and you can also be of support by, again, maybe doing some research on an organization or a human service organization and finding out ways to volunteer.
Right.
There's always a way to give back.
Yeah. Well, I know here in Massachusetts, we have the Department of Family, Children and Family, and one of the ways that I'm choosing to help out this year is to buy a backpack for a kid, because I was horrified to hear that most kids in the foster care system, when they move from one place to another, they do it with a big garbage bag.
Yeah, and that's funny you say that, because that is how they, you know, tend to connect that, where they, you know, just dump all their things in a trash bag and they move from home to home. And then there are organizations that are trying to have these children leave with dignity. Mm-hmm. So they do trunk parties for them. And so they put their things in a nice luggage or a nice chest or a nice trunk. So that way they leave with a sense of dignity. But that, you know, that's a running story. People have, you know, said that. And so there are organizations, I know there are tons of, I know Tiffany Haddish, she's a comedian. She's a product of the foster care system, and she has a program where that's what she does. That's her nonprofit where she provides, you know, services for children in foster care. And so, yeah, that is definitely a way that you can do it. There's tons of ways. And even think creatively, right? What can you do, right? If you want, as you mentioned, a backpack is a very important tool. My kid has a backpack. He loses it all the time. You have to buy backpacks again and again. And so in that regard, just find a way to do something.
Right.
You know, again, love is an action word. You have to do something.
Yeah. Well, let's give folks a path to take some action and let them know where they can go to find out more about My Journey to Joshua, find out more about you, and maybe start thinking about becoming a foster parent.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And so you can actually find both books on my website, myjourneytojoshua.com. And you can also follow me on all social media platforms at From Fears to Families. So again, From Fears to Families is on all social platforms. And my website is myjourneytojoshua.com.
We've had a great time speaking to the author of My Journey to Joshua. Our guest has been Deborah Olivia Farmer. Deborah, thanks so much for being on Reading with Your Kids.
Thank you for having me. You have a great holiday season coming up. I appreciate it.
Are you looking for a creative way to bond with your kids? Let me tell you all about Drawing with Your Kids, the ultimate destination for artistic adventures. Join us as we dive into the wonderful world of children's books with renowned illustrators guiding you step by step. From beloved characters to whimsical scenes, unleash your imagination and create cherished memories together. Whether you're a seasoned artist or just picking up a pencil, there's something for everyone at Drawing with Your Kids. Please visit our website, readingwithyourkids.com, and click on the Drawing with Your Kids link at the top of the page and let the creativity flow. Drawing with Your Kids, where every stroke brings stories to life. Join us right now from the great state of Arizona. Our guest is here today to celebrate. His new picture book is called The Roast Beef Chief, The Broccoli Redemption. Please welcome to the show, Jacob Teat. Jacob, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for asking. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Here, I was going to complain about the heat here in Boston this summer, but I'm talking to a guy in Arizona who probably knows all about heat.
Well, I grew up near Death Valley in California. Plus, I've lived in Pensacola, Florida, as well as here. So heat is nothing new to me. And I still don't like it. So,
well, Boston this summer, it happened again. We had about a month ago, we had a week where it was Monday, it was 103. Tuesday, it was 95. And Wednesday, it was 63.
63?
Yes. Yes. Wow. A little crazy.
That sounds beautiful.
So tell me about Roast Beef Chief. Who is this character?
So I'll give you a little bit of backstory for it real quick. Sure. When just about a year or so ago, my stepdaughter, she asked me at bedtime, she just asked me for a bedtime story involving a sandwich, giving me zero time to come up with anything. And so I came up with the character, Roast Beef Chief. He's a roast beef sandwich, a chief of police where he goes and solves food-related crime. So I built this whole universe with it, and it was all off of a, can I have a bedtime story involving a sandwich? And her and my stepson love it. And so after a while, there's some things that have gone on that are outside of my control, so I wanted to leave a legacy built on truth. And so I'm using this as my avenue.
Interesting. How old was the stepdaughter that gave you this prompt?
She was like 3.5.
Three. So she wasn't trying to trip you up. That's, you know, that's
no.
A pretty innocent thing.
No, it was a very innocent thing. But I came up with Roast Beef Chief and started coming up with just random stories. As a storyteller in general, I enjoy using stories to teach lessons. Mm-hmm. To teach morals. I mean, you can go as far back before even the printing press. That's how we've always taught, is through stories. That's how Jesus taught in the Bible. It's always a parable. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you how the kingdom of God is. And it's always a story.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to use this story, this universe that I've created, to use that as a way to teach not just my stepkids, but kids everywhere.
Uh-huh. What truth are we trying to teach kids through the Broccoli Redemption?
Well, for the Broccoli Redemption one, because I'm hoping for it to become a series. But the redemption is, for one, someone's always watching you. And somebody's going to follow you if you, and using that role in a positive light and not a negative light. So Brock, his name, the character's name is Brock Lee. So, and it's a piece of broccoli. And he wanted to be a police officer growing up. But then he made some bad decisions. And then he noticed eventually there was a kid named Baby Carrot. He was also a carrot. Following his lead and not doing so well. And so the truth of this one is true character is going to show through no matter what. And you have to make that, and doing the right thing you need to do when nobody's watching, because there's truly never no one watching. Mm-hmm. So if you're an older brother to a little brother, your little brother is watching you. If you're a dad or a stepdad, your kids are watching you, or your wife is watching you. It's everything you do, there's somebody watching. So you got to just choose the right thing. And kind of the tagline of this one is, to be a hero, it's just one right choice at a time.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. And that is a good lesson, I think, for parents, just to remind us that our kids are watching us and we are modeling for them, whether it's being a good model or a bad model. Not necessarily that a parent's going to be committing a crime or whatnot, but just simple things. If our kids see us reading instead of scrolling through our phone, that's a great way to model and help inspire a love of reading in our kids.
Well, I mean, that is very true. Me and my stepson, I loved reading Scooby-Doo with him. Mm-hmm. We always read Scooby-Doo. I'd do the voices. I'd do Shaggy and Scooby. And my favorite is The Investigators. And I'm a Florida Gator fan, so Investigators is something I just really enjoyed. So just sitting down on the couch and reading before bed or reading while getting this haircut, it was always a blast. But, even moral choices that we make, we have to show that just because it's not a crime, but there are morals that we have to instill as well. And we have to live those and not just tell them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Did you have, before you got this prompt and you created this character, did you ever think about writing children's stories?
No, absolutely not. This is again for me to just like leave a legacy. I've always been a storyteller. Mm-hmm. Like that is something the Lord has gifted me with, the gift of gab, which you will find out within this interview. But it wasn't something I really thought of until this. And this is, you know, I came up with some character designs and I was showing some people, some friends I have, and they're like, man, this is really creative. You should see. And, you know, when I tell the backstory, and then they read the book, and I don't have a copy with me, unfortunately. I gave my last copy away, so I had to order some more. But, you know, they all, man, this is a really cool idea. This is so cute. And it just kind of went from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think the Roast Beef Chief certainly would be a lovable character, and I think it's something that you could absolutely turn into a series. Do you have any working titles for the other books in the series?
Yeah. So the next book I have is going to be Framed and Flame Broiled. He's going to lose everything. He's going to be framed, and then Brock Lee is going to come back and help him like regain everything and prove his innocence.
Yeah.
And then there's the Onion Ring Sting is going to be one. I have a couple of more. I don't exactly remember all the titles that I have come up with, but I have about four or five working ones that I'm going to, you know, have ready to go once hopefully this takes off.
We've had a great time speaking to the author of Roast Beef Chief, The Broccoli Redemption. Our guest has been Jacob T. We got to start calling you Jay Rubin so the people know online.
You can definitely call me Jay Rubin if you'd like.
Thanks for being on Reading with Your Kids.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
You too. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Reading with Your Kids and will join us for the next exciting episode of the show. this episode made you smile or gave you something to think about, please consider sharing a link to the show with someone you love. Also, please consider leaving a 5-star review wherever you find your show. And of course, we'd love it if you could subscribe to the show. Want to thank the folks who made today's show so wonderful, starting with our guest, Jenny Holm. Please be sure to check out Jenny's new middle grade novel. It's called Outside. Also want to thank Deborah Olivia Farmer. Please be sure to check out her memoir, My Journey to Joshua, From Fears to Family. I also want to thank Jacob Teep. Be sure to check out The Roast Beef Chief. My team deserves a big round of applause, Christopher Daugherty, Fatima Khan. I want to thank my beautiful wife for all the support she gives me. Most of all, we all want to thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. And as always, thank you so very much for taking the time to make the world a better place. And you do that every single time you read with your kids. I'll be looking for you in the next episode of Reading with Your Kids.